sky's so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. Call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. The number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. We'll be taking your calls in just a few minutes here. Start out the plant of the week, golden privet. Good morning, Ton.
Good morning.
So tell us about golden privet.
Well, golden privet is a shrub that's been around for quite a while, and as the name implies, it has a bright yellow leaf when the new growth comes out that fades to kind of a chartreuse or a really nice shade of green.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk about this one. It's just because the privet plants have been around for a long, long time. There's a whole group of them. We've talked about low-dense privet, which only gets 3 or 4 feet tall. And there's, you know, Cheyenne privet, Chinese privet, Amur River privet. There's all these different species. But the golden privet is one that I think is showier. And it also is, the flowers are sterile, so it's not going to spread. And a lot of the United States, many of the privet species have been banned because they've become invasive in our forests and along our waterways. I've even seen in Utah County, going upper canyons, privet sprouting up along the riverways and things. And so it's not as bad here, but anywhere there's moisture available, there's that potential. But this particular privet is a tough, durable shrub, and it doesn't have that potential to become invasive.
Okay, so how big does it get?
It depends on the type. Most often, you're just going to find what's called golden privet, or sometimes it's called golden vickery privet.
Mm-hmm.
And they are going to get 10 to 12 feet tall without pruning. You can keep them down to 6 if you do use some renewal pruning and a little bit of shearing, but they will get taller. There is a proven winner's variety called golden ticket that grows only between 4 and 6 feet. And so if you need a smaller hedge, many retailers carry the Proven Winners lines. And so the golden ticket privet might be one that you could use.
Why do they say put it in an informal hedge?
Because it gets big. It will hedge formally, but it needs to be left bigger. You know, if you need a small 2 to 3 or 4 foot tall hedge, this will do that for 3, 4, 5 years, but it wants to be 10 feet tall, so you would need to let it grow, or eventually you just train it and prune it into stubs. And so it will do well informally. If you want, you can mix it with like Rose of Sharon and lilac and things and just mix it up along, say, a fence line, and you'll have something giving you color most of the season if you do that. But it also, if you don't trim it down into nothing, tolerates formal pruning, and it makes actually quite a beautiful formal hedge.
Okay. So full sun.
Yes.
So it'll tolerate the west side of your house.
Absolutely.
And will it still look good? Like,
yes.
Some things tolerate, but they don't look great.
Privet, especially this golden privet, will grow almost anywhere. In fact, the shade is actually the least favorable place to grow it, because the yellow foliage quickly fades to green, and because it needs sunlight. And so in shade, a lot of times our plants that are either red or yellow colored will fade to green to maximize the amount of chloroplast and photosynthesis to get more sunlight. But hot south exposure, it's actually a plant that is used quite a bit in apartment complexes, industrial parks, because it's so durable. Once it's planted and established, about the only thing that will go after it are strawberry, or just root weevils, like strawberry root weevil. They notch the leaves. And so you may need to monitor and spray for that. But otherwise, there just isn't much that gets it.
What does it need as far as water and soil?
Average amount of water. So once established, after 2 to 3 years, watered weekly to a depth of about a foot. And any soil, almost, as long as it's not too salty. It grows in clay, it grows in sand, and does just fine. It is one that, you know, in Eagle Mountain and areas, it should do okay. You know, again, if your soil's the measure of the salinity is above 2.5 or 3, I'd be a little cautious. But this is just a very durable plant.
All right, one that you don't have to mess with a whole lot.
No, it's just one that it's pretty. It's durable, it's utilitarian, it's pest and disease resistant. And so if you need something that you don't want to pay a lot of attention to after it's established, these golden privet are really a candidate for that.
All right. The golden privet shrub. My words today, I want to combine bush and shrub. The golden privet shrub is the plant of the week, and you can find out more on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. I need to tell our listeners that we have a shortened show today. We have NCAA men's basketball, BYU versus Texas. Our pregame begins at 11, so if you have a burning question, you need to get your call in as soon as possible. Number to call, phone lines are open, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Good morning. Thanks for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Number to call with your questions. Phone lines are open, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Let's go to our text line. We have a number of questions coming in. The first one, this person says they have grass under their huge elm tree, but it's not growing well. Could it be too much shade? It's on the south side of their home.
It absolutely could be too much shade. When you have excessive shade, the grass and most other things don't do well. There are a few weeds that will grow in that sort of shade, but it's something that they may need to limb the tree up. Or if they want grass under there, they could try planting red fescue under it. It's a turf grass. It looks different, not incredibly so, but it has a slightly different texture than Kentucky bluegrass. But they could top dress or go aerate under there and then put down red fescue seed this spring and see if it will establish. If the red fescue doesn't, what will often happen is it will grow for a couple of years and fade out. Mm-hmm. And if you cannot grow red fescue under there, there is no turf grass that will. Oh. And so you either need to open up the shade a little bit to let some sunlight in, or you need to put bark mulch under the tree and just go that direction.
Call it good.
Yeah.
All right. Next listener wants to know, with these unseasonable temperatures,
unseasonable,
my brain isn't working properly, and that along with autocorrect, with these unseasonable temperatures, is this going to affect the pruning of their fruit trees?
No, they need to prune at the recommended times, the pears and apples in mid-February and the stone fruits in mid-March. What I'm worried about is that in fruit trees, they accumulate what are called degree days, and every fruit tree that we grow here has a certain number of hours of coldness that it needs to be exposed to before it can break dormancy. Mm-hmm. And some of our hardiest trees, you know, will require anywhere from 600 to 1,000 hours at around 40 degrees. And the 40 degree temperature is the max wherein those trees are accumulating the maximum number of degree days. At 30 degrees, they're still accumulating some, but it's fewer. And so we've been at 40 for so long that the trees will stay dormant, but that programmed dormancy from the required degree days is no longer there. And so if we warm up for a couple of weeks into the 60s, say sometime in mid to late March, they could bloom. And then we get cold again and they get frozen off. And so this temperatures we've been having at 40 to 45 degrees every day is really kind of scary for especially our apricots or European or Japanese plums, even our peaches, because we don't want them to bloom too early, because those two kinds of dormancy where you have the degree day model, and then if it's cold, they stay dormant, but as soon as it warms up, they'll pop. And so if we, the two dangers are we get warm and then cold again, or 3 or 4 years ago, we just stayed in the 50s through April and the trees tried to bloom, but it was too cold for honeybees. And we had a really light fruit year, a crop that year, because of those sustained cool temperatures through April into May. And so it's not that I want to get colder, but just 3 or 4 degrees daily would be something we could use for the fruit trees so that they can go through their life cycle normally and not have this strange kind of warm weather, you know, through February.
So it definitely could impact it could. Pruning.
It could. Well, pruning itself, no. It's just the blossoming that I'm more worried about. You prune when during those recommended times.
So you're still going to prune during the same times.
You are.
Okay.
But it's more the degree days we've been accumulating the last 2 or 3 weeks. Those trees are, as soon as we're warm, they're going to be ready to go. And there's usually, when we start, if we have an average year, there's usually about a week to 10 days that those trees will stay dormant before those blossoms open. But because they've accumulated all the required degree days, they're going to open a lot faster than they normally would if we get warm.
Yesterday was so nice. I actually spent an hour out in my yard.
Yeah.
And all the snow melted off. I mean, we live on the bench, and all the snow melted off the front yard, which faces west, of course. But
yeah, I've been outside in just a long sleeve shirt or maybe a sweatshirt. I haven't had to wear a coat in quite a while.
Yeah, there was some leaves that I didn't get to, so I was out raking a few leaves, getting some fresh air. It was great, but kind of concerning at the same time.
It is.
All right, next listener says they have an old Jonathan apple tree that's in a 2-year feast and famine cycle. What can they do to break the cycle?
Thin it. They need to, after it blossoms and the fruit's the size of about a pea to a dime, they leave one apple per cluster, because generally there will be a cluster of anywhere from 2 to 4, maybe 5 apples. Mm-hmm. And they're going to leave what's called the king bloom or the king fruit. And that's going to be the biggest one in the cluster, and they just need to go in and thin the rest off so that there's one apple for every 6 inches to foot of branch.
Marilyn in Garland says that she's tried several times to grow cabbage. Covered the plants and controlled butterflies and caterpillars, but have had major problems with aphids. Any suggestions on how to control aphids with cabbage?
The only thing besides the use of pesticides that I know to do is to get the cabbage in, and before you plant it, you may actually almost dunk the top of the plant, if you're doing transplants, into some soapy water, just to almost baptize it to kill any aphids or anything on there, and then rinse it off after you've done a thorough wash. Then plant it, but then they're going to need to get what's called floating row cover and tent those plants, and they're going to need almost a low tunnel, and that's they're going to have to make sure that there aren't any gaps in there so that the cabbage looper moth and different things can't get in there to feed, because sometimes, especially if you grew them there the previous year, or broccoli or something, you trap them in there. And so you need to plant them in a new spot and immediately tent them under floating row cover. There are some systemics out there that will work well, but I don't like putting systemics on my food. So
if she's trying to plant them in the same spot, that's the reason the aphids are coming back.
Well, it can be. And so she needs to rotate to a new area in case there's overwintering pests in that soil, and then use the low tunnel frames and put floating row cover over the top and seal it in really well with soil so that the little beasties can't crawl under it.
So when you say baptize that plant when you get it, does that mean that the aphids oftentimes come with the plant?
They can.
Okay.
They can,
so
not
always. So you're eliminating a lot of the possibilities.
You are. And so if you have transplants, what you would do is just make sure that you're securing them in the tray or the little pot, and then you just get yourself, say, a gallon of lukewarm soapy water, two or three drops of dish soap in there, and then just dunk it in to the soil. And then just kind of stir it around a little bit so that everything is submerged. Pull it out and then just gently rinse that start with lukewarm water and let it dry. Okay. And that way, any aphids, spider mites, anything along those lines are most likely going to be dead if you've used that soapy water.
We're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Text us 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Tom Bettis with you this morning, taking your calls. Phone lines are open at 801-575-8255. You can text us your questions at 57500. Our next texter, Tom, says they have a 20-foot wide section on their property. They want to get a columnar flowering or shade tree, and the height doesn't matter. Any suggestions?
There's a few they could use. There is a columnar oak that maxes at about 25 to 30 feet, but it's narrow. Mm-hmm. It's called Kindred Spirit, and it's a really neat little tree. My neighbors have some that have been in for 7 or 8 years, and they've reached 15 feet. And I think they do some minor trimming on them just to keep their shape up. But that's one that's going to be around in 50 or 100 years because the oaks are very long lived. If they want flowering, you're a little more limited. There are columnar flowering cherries. If they could find them, flowering sergeant cherry is one they could look at. There is a columnar Quanzon cherry, but the Quanzons are probably the most showy of the flowering columnar cherries, but they're also their duration isn't there. They're getting about 15 to 20 years and they're going to die. That's just what Quanzon cherries do, and you expect that when you plant them. And then there's also a columnar flowering plum that will give you 25 or 30 years. Now, all of these are going to eventually require a little bit of pruning, but I think they're fine. There's also some columnar crab apples, one called Merrill Lee that gets about 20 feet tall and 10, 12 feet wide. So I believe Cameron over at Progressives carries Merrill Lee, and it can be found at other garden centers too. But of that list, I would go with Kindred Spirit Oak or Merrill Lee Crab Apple.
Okay. Terry from Mountain West says that, not sure if it's he or she, collected bristlecone pine cones in Colorado, let them open over the winter. Now the seeds fell out. They want to know the best way to grow them in pots to eventually plant them in the yard.
Be patient, because you can plant them, and I would have to look at the stratification protocols, and they're going to be online, but if you do an internet search of stratifying the Pinus edulis, what's the common name again?
The bristlecone.
Not Pinus edulis, flexilis. If stratifying bristlecone pine seed, it'll bring up what they need to do.
Okay.
But there could be a couple of year process for some of these. But even when they sprout, it'll be 5 or 6 years before those trees are big enough to plant outside.
Patience.
And it'd
fun
be
experiment, though.
Yeah, up to 50 years, between 20 and 50 years before they ever produce pine cones, you know, to mature and things. And so they're just going to be slower growing. Now, the bristle cone is one that I think it would be fun to do. And what they would have to do is just leave them in the pots, and they might have to transplant them up, but they can be overwintered in a shed over the winter or planted in a protected spot. But it's just one that they're going to need to keep away from deer and protect, because it'll be years before it's big enough to really give them a lot of ornamental value.
Yeah, they were wondering, is there a best time of year to plant them? Like,
if you're just wanting to put them in the ground, you put them in the soil.
They want to start in pots.
This is not just something you plant and start. Unfortunately, they're not like a marigold, or they need to look up the propagation protocols, because these native plants, especially that are adapted to arid areas, they have all sorts of adaptations that limit germination, so that the conditions have to be right, because there has to be enough moisture in the soil for them to take. And so they have all these pre-programmed adaptations in the seeds, and it's just, you don't throw them in soil and just let them sprout.
Okay.
And so it makes it difficult to do, and that's why they really need to look up a propagation protocol.
Where would be the best place to
Google?
Do that? There's not like a, like there, USU doesn't have propagation of these. Oh no.
No. It's such a specific
okay.
niche thing, but there are areas out there, universities will have it, and areas that specialize in native plants, but it's something, and the information is out there, but they need to look it up, and this is going to be a commitment for them to do.
Okay, would they put EDU in their search?
They don't necessarily need to. It's such a specialized search.
They're going to only find very few.
Yeah, they're going to find very few. And there are a few native plants journals. There are a few universities that have websites that are dedicated to propagation. Oregon State University may have a few things in their horticulture program. So it's out there, but it's not that it's going to be very obscure, but it's just a very specialized thing.
Okay. Scott is on the line in Tooele. Good morning, Scott. What was your question?
Two quick questions. Mm-hmm. One, if you could control the ground temperature for your fruit trees and keep it cool longer in the spring, how would that affect the time they bloom?
It would delay blooming a bit. There were some professors in the 70s at USU that did these kinds of experiments. They actually wrapped refrigerator coils around tree trunks and kept the trunks cold longer, and they delayed blooming for 3 or 4 days, but the expense at doing it was huge. I mean, you could probably go to Eastern Washington or, you know, some of the fruit growing areas and pay about as much as you would for the electricity to do it and the equipment as it would be to just, you know, take your lumps and lose your fruit sometime.
Thank you. The other question, here in Tooele, the soil doesn't freeze very much because there's usually snow on the ground. But I have a pear tree and it gets something in it. I can't say that it's worms or larvae, but it ruins the pears. But most years it just destroys my pears. But
now when you say what's happening to the pears?
Something burrows into them and spoils them, and it goes right to the core where the seeds are, and the rottenness comes right from the core.
And are you spraying the trees for coddling moth?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I haven't sprayed at all.
I mean, it's when you grow fruit trees for fruit, but the best analogy I can give you is like buying a car and not changing the oil and then expecting the car to go 200,000 miles. You know, when you have fruit trees, they do need to be sprayed. You can do it organically, and there's organic sprays out there. But you're getting coddling moth most likely in those pears, and that's what is causing them to spoil.
Where do they come from?
Satan. No. No, they're just a natural pest. They were probably the apples we grow are native to Asia, and they were probably imported as we brought them from Europe to North America to grow them. Some of the pests we have here are native, but they're established here in Utah. In northern Utah, they have 3 generations per year, and they overwinter under your pear trees. And so some other things you can do: clean up the fruit that you don't use off the ground and throw it away or compost it, and then spray, especially those first 2 sprays. I would recommend subscribing to the USU Pest Lab updates. They're free, and they just come in email, and they'll tell you down to the day when you need to spray, and they'll give you both conventional and organic options. And so you could probably get away with spraying just 2 or 3 times through the season to keep most of that coddling moth out.
Thanks. I'll get a hold of
them. One other question for you real quick. When you harvest your pears, are you letting them ripen on the tree or are you picking them a bit early?
I have a hard time telling when they're ripe.
So what you're going to want to do is let the pears start to drop. And when you see you're going out there and kind of looking, and you see like 5 or 10 of them that have dropped off the tree. On the south and west side of the tree, go and grab one of the larger fruit that's been exposed to the sun and just kind of twist and pull. If that pear comes off easily and doesn't yank leaves off, they're ready to be picked. And so you'll pick those on the south and west first, and then the ones on the interior of the tree and the north and east sides about 5 to 7 days later. Do you have Bartlett pear or are they Anjou's? What kind of pears are they?
Anjou.
Okay, so they're Anjou. So what you're going to do is bring them in the house and then refrigerate them for between about 3 and 6 weeks. They need to go in the refrigerator. But then you can start taking them out of the refrigerator and finish ripening on your counter. And it'll take anywhere from 3 to 7 days to ripen. But those Anjou pears, they're called a winter pear. And you can look up online care of winter pears. But they're meant to be able to be refrigerated most of the winter, and you just pull them out as you need them and let them sit for 3 or 4 days, and they're absolutely delicious.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Scott, thanks so much for your call this morning. We need to take a break. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500. Thanks for joining us this morning for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Terry would like to know. Terry has grapevines on a pergola in their backyard, and every fall they've been getting thousands of white gnats in their grapes, and they want to know, what are they and how can they get rid of them this year?
It's Western Grape Leaf Hopper. And USU has fact sheets out on it. But they're going to, if they're building into the thousands, and they can defoliate the grapes and over time cause quite a bit of damage, you know, reduce productivity and eventually kill them. So there's a few things they can do, but as in the summer, you know, as soon as we start to turn hot, they need to monitor those grapes a couple of times a week, go out and tap on the leaves a little bit and just investigate. And as soon as they start to see those leaf hoppers in there, they need to go to the garden center and get a spray, something with permethrin, or there's a number of them out there. And depending on the particular spray, they may need to spray weekly for 2 or 3 weeks to control them enough to get them through the season.
Next listener would like to know if they can put used coffee grounds, till them into the soil in Kaysville.
That is fine. It's you don't want to saturate the soil with them, but an inch of them tilled in 5 or 6 inches deep or worked into the soil that deep is just fine.
Next listener is moving to Fairview, elevation about 6,000 feet. They're wondering what fruit trees will grow and produce in that climate.
Well, I want to bring up really quick, I'm glad they specified the city, because 6,000 feet in Fairview is far different than 55 or 6,000 feet all along the Wasatch Front. Mm-hmm. And so they want to know which fruit trees.
What they could grow there that would be successful.
There's a lot of things, and there's not enough time to mention it all. We would need some more specifics. So that might be a phone call, but you know, they're probably a warm zone four, zone five, as far as USDA cold hardiness goes, but there's all sorts of things they can grow.
Next listener says, can you tell them if they can spray a field? I'm going to need some time to figure out what that says. The last person wants to know where to sign up for the pest lab updates at USU.
I will find them on the break and then have Michelle post it to Facebook.
Okay, so we're going to give them that
information.
Okay, when we come back following the top of the hour news, we are going to be talking about blackberry management in Utah and selecting blackberries in Utah. So we hope you will stay with us through the top of the hour news for that special feature. And then we'll be taking more of your calls and questions. And our phone lines are open, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Check out the plant of the week, the golden privet.
Never seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care.
Hey, 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 hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, hey, it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse, a shortened edition this morning. We are making way for BYU men's basketball. It's BYU versus Texas, and our pregame begins at 11 with a tip-off at noon. So if you have questions, you want to get your calls in now at 801-575-8255, or you can text us at 57500. Wanted to start out the morning, top of the hour, 9 o'clock feature is blackberries, selecting blackberries that are best for our area, as well as managing them once you get them in the ground. So let's start out with how do people select the best blackberries for our area?
Well, some of it is going to be what you want out of a blackberry, but we are as far north as you can get and somewhat reliably grow blackberries. There are some hardier varieties out there, but you know, it becomes slim pickings when you get much colder than the Wasatch Front. Just for example, and we'll get into better varieties, but the most cold hardy blackberry out there is called Illini Hardy. And you really have got to want blackberries if you grow Illini Hardy, because it is a good berry, but it's as thorny as you can get. And so even wearing a long sleeve shirt and some sort of gloves to pick them, you will be cut up. And so I knew people.
Well, that doesn't sound fun.
No, but I knew people in Cache Valley that were just like, well, this is how they grow in the forest. And they did grow Illini Hardy, and they were a pretty good berry. They have, and I don't know what this really means, but it says, well, they have that wild blackberry taste. You know, I don't want the cultivated taste. I want the wild taste. And so, you know, more power to you.
I have no idea what that means.
I don't either, but that's all how right. It was described. And I had more than one person tell me that.
I believe
but
them.
I mean, for the more reasonable people, for our gentle listeners that don't want the adventure of Illini Hardy blackberry, there are several thornless varieties that do really well along the Wasatch Front. And we've posted a fact sheet that Dr. Brent Black and Sheridan Hansen, among others, did the work for to gauge cold hardiness, or at least winter injury, in blackberries. And they've listed several varieties from the most hardy to the least hardy as far as winter damage. And the three that I usually recommend from this work, there's one called Navajo, and it's spelled N-A-V-A-H-O. So Navajo, then Chester, which is going to be very hardy, and then another one called Triple Crown. And those three seem to do relatively well. And when we get down near zero or a little colder, a lot of the branches survive, and you can get a good crop the next year.
Okay. So that's three good.
Three good varieties. There's others out there, Apache. And so when you're purchasing blackberries, the ones you want to avoid are what are called trailing blackberries. And they're the varieties grown in the Pacific Northwest. And many of these are also thornless, but they are only hardy down to about 10 to 15 degrees. And so only on the warmest areas of the Wasatch Front will they survive. So I'm talking Loganberry, Dewberry, Marionberry, some of these famous ones that you can get the syrups and jams and things. They're not hardy here. And I don't know, unless you're just a hobbyist, I don't know that I would want to put the time into growing these trailing blackberries. You know, if you lived in Moab or St. George, where it can get a little warm, you could maybe try them there. Mm-hmm. But you want the what are called erect or semi-erect blackberries. And these are going to go more straight up like a raspberry would. And so the Illini Hardy, the Chester, Triple Crown, all of these are semi-erect or erect blackberries. So you're going to actually grow them a little bit more like you would a raspberry, to where you're going to trellis them. and you're going to let them just plant the starts, and you usually buy them as a rooted cutting in a 6-inch pot from a nursery. Plant it, let it grow for a year or two, but we have a fact sheet posted on maintenance. And like raspberries, once you get them established, they generally fruit on one-year-old canes. And so this year's new growth will be next year's berries. And so the terms in the fact sheet are primacane and floracane. Just remember, prime is first year and floracane is the second year, flora implying flowering. And so once those canes or branches have produced the berries, if anybody from ESU is listening, I use that term loosely. I know they're not really berries, but once you harvest the blackberries in the fall or winter, those canes that you harvested from are cut out. And then the new growth is trimmed back. And there's some instructions in there on trellising the blackberries, but to maintain them properly and to keep their size in check, you're always cutting out the canes that produce fruit in the winter after they produced.
Right. Sounds like the biggest thing people do wrong is they cut the wrong canes.
They do. Or they don't cut at all. And so, I mean, there's those folks out there that just run these on a chain link fence and they act kind of like a screen. But you do that and the fruit production is reduced a little bit and they can get 30 to 40 feet long, you know, wide.
Wow.
Massive. And so if you are growing blackberries for food production exclusively, you know, in a garden situation, there's instructions on how wide your rows need to be, how to trellis them, and how to increase your productivity and make the fruit a little bit sweeter.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
I'll start looking for blackberries between March and mid-May, and there's several varieties out there. You can look them up online, but again, if you're the Loganberry berries, the Dewberries, the Marion berries, the famous varieties out of the Pacific Northwest, unfortunately, just aren't hardy along the Wasatch Front.
Okay. The top of the hour feature has been blackberries, how to choose them, and how, again, to manage them. And you can find more information on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. If you're just tuning in, you can find our show, the entire show, in podcast form shortly after the show airs. So if you missed the discussion, you can catch it there as well. Get your phone calls in now, only about 45 minutes till the top of the hour, and that means we will go to BYU basketball at that point in time, so you want to get your calls in before then. 801-575-8255. Text us 57500. Good morning. Thanks for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open. You can text us at 57500. Next listener, Ton, is very unhappy with the squirrels in the 9th and 9th area. This person has beautiful lilies in pots that bloom every spring, and then they die back. And they just leave them in the pots, and the rest of the year they get water and snow, you know, from the snow and stuff, and then they bloom again the next year. But the squirrels have decided to dig up a lot of the bulbs to eat, and they're wondering what they can do to discourage the squirrels from eating the bulbs. Last year, they ate the bulbs out of their window boxes. Good grief, squirrels.
They're going to have to cover the bulbs. And so
some sort of netting?
You'd probably need metal netting. So metal screening like you'd put into your windows and cut it to fit over the window box. But then I would fasten it to some boards, some 2x4s or 1x2s.
They can just move them, right?
Yeah, so you can just roll them up and move them when the bulbs start to grow. And there's other food sources out there. And that way, if they needed to, they could screw the wood down or clamp it to the boxes and then just take it off and put it in a shed for the summer. If the bulbs are in the ground, you can cover them with boards or use something similar to where you're covering the area with that metal screening and the wood stones, anything along those lines. But you know that that's going to have to be moved in early to mid-March when the bulbs start to sprout.
Okay, nothing like squirrels. And then
oh, man.
People say, oh, they're so cute, but they leave behind a mess. They dig up your tulip bulbs and they leave the husks.
They do.
If you're going to eat my bulbs, at least don't make a
mess. Add insult to injury.
Right.
Yeah, there's a new species over the last 10 years that's been coming north out of Texas, and it's followed the Rio Grande drainage and the Colorado River drainage north, and we're starting to see this non-native, when I say that, to Utah squirrel in yards and things. And last time I checked, and it's been a couple of years, the state was unsure if they wanted to declare it noxious or invasive or just let nature run its course because it's come in naturally, but we don't know how much human influence was there on it. And so this new squirrel seems to be a little bit more adapted to living in urban areas. And I think that's part of the reason we've been seeing more squirrels in our neighborhoods.
Our next listener is making a suggestion that I'd like you to comment on, this having to do with the coddling moth and the pears that we talked about. And they're saying if you don't like to spray your fruit trees, you can bag your fruit to avoid coddling moth. They say it's a lot of work, but it helps to thin the pears and avoid bird pecks too.
It does. You can buy the bags on Amazon and potentially from local retailers. And depending on the style of bag, it can be a thick paper bag that has the metal clips, almost like, I'm trying to remember, they're the metal that you can fold over on some of the foods, like the Mint Milano cookies used to have them from Pepperidge Farms, that you'd fold the bag over and then fold the metal clips.
Oh, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so you can buy bags like that. There's several styles. And if you thin your pears, as the pears grow, you can put these bags on the pears and they work well. But as they mentioned, it's labor intensive. We've had that gentleman on in the past that was selling the entire tree nets that you
right.
had to prune the trees a bit, but you can net the entire stinking tree and keep them out. And so there are some non-pesticide alternatives out there, but you just have to adjust accordingly.
Do the pesticides, are they harming us? Is there any research that shows that these pesticides are dangerous for us?
Sometimes, yes. I mean, I think that there's definitely a movement out there and a political movement trying to get these things banned that I think the intentions are far more than just our safety. You know, I don't want to get too much into politics, but yeah, there's examples of pesticides harming us. Every time you go to the bathroom, you excrete a certain amount of DDT and glyphosate every time. That's just in our bodies. You know, is that harmful? More and more research is showing that glyphosate, we may need to check its use a bit, especially in big industrial ag. Dicamba is another one. So there are definitely examples out there. And so people have been more and more hesitant to use pesticides, and I get it. You know, I'm in the same boat. But you can spray the trees organically, and these organic sprays are oftentimes going to break down faster, and there's not going to have as much of a residual. But the trade-off is you're potentially going to have a few more little beasties in your fruit that you don't want, and you're probably going to have to spray a little more often and have the timing there so that you spray at the right time because the residual isn't as long. But, you know, there's the fruit bags, there's the nets you can use. But if you're not netting or bagging your fruit, you're doing your entire neighborhood a disservice with you being the ones like, oh, we're environmentally conscious, we're not going to spray our fruit. Well, you're the source of diseases and pests for the neighborhood by not doing that.
Wow. It's a fine line to walk, isn't it?
It is.
All right. Jane is on the line in Salt Lake City. Good morning, Jane. What was your question this morning?
Oh, I just need to know when and how low you cut hydrangeas when they're true blooming.
I wouldn't cut them. And so you need to know the kind of hydrangea you have because some of them bloom on new growth and some of them bloom on one-year-old wood. And if you need to prune them, I would use a technique called renewal pruning where you're taking 20% of the branches out from near the base of the shrub every mid-March and leaving mm-hmm. everything else behind. And that will help keep the size in check, but still have the potential there for the maximum amount of blooms. But don't just go out there and shear them unless you know what you have.
Okay, that's good advice. And also I need to know, when you buy the amaryllis in the stores, and they have this little plastic bowl around the roots. Do you cut that off and put it in new soil, or do you just water through that bowl?
It depends on your plan. If you're just going to dispose of it when it's done blooming, don't go to the effort. But if you're going to keep it for years, definitely transplant it into a pot.
Oh, okay. That's all my questions, and thank you very much.
All right, Jane, thanks for your call this morning. Next listener lives in Utah County. They have found pennycress growing as well as henbit growing in their flower beds. Can they spray for those weeds now so they don't multiply in the spring?
It's too cold to spray for to get a lot of impact from any spray. They could, if the beds are bare, get a weed torch and crisp them up a little bit. You're not going to start a fire in the middle of the winter unless there's debris all over in the flower beds. Because the soil's wet and frozen, there's little risk. And that would be a great way to get some satisfaction.
All right. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse Show. I missed one of our callers that asked us about the golden privet earlier, Ton. That is the plant of the week, and whether it tolerates wind.
It's fine in the wind. I mean, if you live in South Weber, up in Weber County, or mouth of some of our canyons, it'll do fine in the wind. It has fairly waxy leaves. You know, like I said, when I worked in the nursery industry and in college, I did a lot of small scale landscaping and landscape maintenance, just, you know, starving students. And one of the go-to plants for a home company we did some contract work for was golden privets. And they planted them everywhere, you know, South Weber, Layton, Kaysville, Farmington, out in West Warren, anywhere they built, and in every situation they did fine. And
well, this person actually wants to know if they'll do well in the middle of Nebraska.
They would be okay. I mean, they're deer candy, and so the deer will get them if they're not protected from that. But as long as the temperatures don't drop below about minus 10, they'll be fine, because they're a zone 5, zone 6 plant. And so warmer areas of Cache Valley, they do just fine. Up in Heber, they're okay, but I wouldn't go much colder than that.
And they're saying, is it an evergreen or deciduous?
Semi-evergreen. And so in St. George, they would be an evergreen. But here along the Wasatch Front, they will hold their leaves through November, and the leaves start to drop in December.
Okay. And again, that was the plant of the week. You can find more on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. Next listener wants to know, is it time to spray cherry trees? And if so, what do they spray them with?
Nah, I'd relax. Go golfing. Take a nap.
Golf?
Yeah.
Maybe today.
Tranquilo. You know, that sort of thing. It's too early to spray. Right now, you know, even with this warmer weather, things are still dormant. It's the time you start spraying is when you start to see fast bud expansion, but before the leaves open.
Next listener wants to know, will sodium chloride snowmelt damage the lawn?
Absolutely. Any salt will damage the lawn. Sodium chloride is the worst. And so you can use a little on your driveway, but it's also the most damaging to cement. And so I personally, even though the water softener salt is the cheapest, it's actually not a great ice melt. Water freezes at a higher temperature with its use. It's really damaging to pavement. It's damaging to your lawns. You want to use one of the others. And they'll say, you know, more environmentally friendly. There's some greenwashing there still, but there are much better ice melts that will melt the ice at lower temperatures and not be nearly as damaging to your plants and to the pavement and to the environment.
Next listener says, with Transjordan out of the compost business, can you recommend a reasonably priced source of good compost or even a high-quality topsoil garden soil?
You know, I've been seeing municipality cities getting out of the green waste business. It's costly.
Oh.
You know, Southern Utah County, in Utah County, there was a circuit of cities that was sharing the mulch and compost equipment to shred the bark up or in the wood up from trees and pallets and things. Mm-hmm. And the equipment itself is very expensive, but then you'd have to transport it from site to site to get your turn. And it just was costing taxpayers a lot of money. And I, you know, I was really torn on the whole thing because now all that wood is just going into the landfill, you know, the branches and the trimming, the tree trimmings and things. And they're telling people to get a shredder and compost it or mulch it at home. Nobody's really doing that. You know, we haven't had a flood of people buying branch shredders and things. And, but it was also costing the taxpayers quite a bit of money to manage these.
But also creating, I mean, such a good service for
it is. And so I don't
take your pickup out there.
In my opinion, it wasn't managed really efficiently, and it could have been managed much more efficiently than what they were doing. But there are still cities out there doing it. Springville City in Utah County, Payson City still has green waste. Up in Weber, Davis, Layton City dump has it, which actually takes into its service area several cities in northern Davis County. And so it's still out there. But if you get compost from a garden center, it is usually going to be more expensive. But, you know, if you're getting local companies, Nutrimulch, Oakdale Egg Farms, they've put a lot of time into trying to make sure it does have the quality there. And any compost, you want to be careful and put it down in the fall and incorporate it into the ground in the fall so that it has time to break down. And if there happens to be any salts or anything in there, they have time to work their way through the soil so that plants aren't harmed in the spring.
Yeah, there are so many great companies out there. You probably want to just price around. Nothing's cheap. Like they,
no.
They have to make a living, right? So you've got your Replenish, the Dirt Bag, and Biograss. All of these companies offer these products, and at certain times, they mark them down. They put
they
them
do.
On sale.
They
especially
do.
Early in the season. So you want to listen for those sales.
Yeah, and if you're looking for the bargain basement prices from the landfills, the best I could really tell you to do, because I don't live in the Salt Lake City area, is look on municipalities' websites where their landfills are and see who is still offering green waste material. And they're still out there, but they are becoming less common.
All right. Next person says they had a small fairy ring in their lawn, so they planted a dwarf mugo pine near that fairy ring. Well, not because of or instead of. But they say that the pine is getting some reddish tips, and they're wondering if it's that fungus.
No, it's not. Reddish tips are a sign of environmental stress. It could be salt if it's near a walkway and had snow piled around it. It could have been drought stress, and the tips of the needles are starting to scorch. It could be that it's a new plant and doesn't have the root mass necessary to get it through the winter. And so what I would do is just make sure that you're not getting any salt on it. And we've had enough rain that the soil is probably moist, but they're just going to have to be patient.
They also planted a scallywag holly in the north, which has a north exposure. It's not getting any new leaves or growing. What could be wrong?
Well, it wouldn't get any new leaves now. And the hollies are just a marginal plant here, except for the blue hollies and in protected areas, English holly. And so I'm the scallywag holly, I'm looking up the species right now. I've seen it out there. Oh, and of course they don't have the species on it.
Well, we're going to take a break. Why
don't okay,
we come back
let's do that.
Give you a few minutes to do a little
okay.
bit of research on that. And number to call 801-575-8255. You can text us 57500. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with taking your calls and questions. Next listener, Ton, says, can they overseed their lawn now before more snow comes?
Oh, they can. The seed won't germinate, and you run into the risk of if birds find it, they may pick some of the seed out. And the seed will just sit there until late March into April when the soil is warm enough for it to germinate. But they absolutely can.
Okay, next listener says, what are the pros and cons of vegetable grow boxes versus just rows? They say they think that their grow boxes need to be solarized again, and they're considering just reverting back to old traditional rows.
The advantage to just traditional gardening in your native soil is that you don't need a lot of inputs to make it happen. It's the least expensive way to garden. The more raised beds, containers, things that you do like that, the more expensive gardening becomes, as they obviously know. And so that's the advantage. The disadvantage is as you age and it becomes harder to bend over and stoop for a long period of time, that it becomes less and less practical. The last year my dad gardened, he had to lay on his side to pull weeds because it was the only position that was comfortable enough to do it. And so you hit that point where the only way you're going to be able to garden is some form of raised bed. Other things with raised beds is that if you have bad soil that's really salty or too clay, they can work. But the expense is the biggest thing with the raised beds and the containers.
Okay. Next person wants to know, how do you maintain cherry bushes, specifically the Romeo and Juliets?
The Romeo and Juliet are dwarf cherries that are super cold hardy that have a sweeter berry. And there's a few ways you could do it. You could treat them just like a little cherry tree. If you wanted to grow them as a bush, you could use renewal pruning on them. But I would recommend growing them as a small cherry tree. We don't really have a lot of time to cover the pruning, but I would look up some fact sheets or YouTube videos on pruning cherries, and that will give them some ideas.
Plus, it's hard to describe over the radio, right?
I wanted to really quick that scallywag holly. Mm-hmm. It is a blue holly, and it will do fine here. They're slow growing, and even then, every once in a while, they're a little hit and miss. But on the north side of your home, you're going to be lucky to get 6 inches a year out of them. Maybe just a couple tablespoons of fertilizer in late March to try to spur some growth. But don't expect that it's going to grow super fast.
And you're not going to see it start get new leaves until when now?
Well, it should hold its leaves over the winter, but the new growth will come out in May.
Okay. Next listener, Ryan, would like to know, what kind of aspen tree would you plant for a small backyard grove in the foothills of Utah County?
If you have the property, any old aspen will work. But if it's a manicured yard, I would plant no aspen just because they sucker all over the place. They're short-lived. And yeah, you're taking away that woodsy feel of the yard, but
especially
I would
a small backyard.
Yeah, I would find a different tree.
Is it a good time to prune a black lace elderberry?
Give it until mid-March and use renewal pruning on there. Look that up online, but you can keep the size down a little bit and generate a lot of new growth, but mid-March.
Isn't straight nitrogen a good snow melt for sidewalks?
The fertilizers are salts, and so they will melt ice, and it's not unheard of for cities to use fertilizer in their mix, something like ammonium nitrate or ammonium sulfate, to melt the snow because it is salts melt ice. It can be damaging to your cement, and there are less expensive things out there, but yes, it will melt ice.
Next listener is growing a Arapahoe blackberry in a big container. Is there something's Arapahoe? Auto
spell check.
They did actually fix it later. Arapahoe blackberry in a big container. Is there something special they should be fertilizing with?
No, it's going to the Arapahoe. I mean, it is going to get some size, and they're going to need to watch that. But because it's in a container, I would use Osmocote or a liquid Miracle-Gro type fertilizer regularly on it, because they do require a lot of nitrogen in a container.
An unusual question. Is there any way to prevent fruit trees, peach trees, from producing fruit?
A pruning cut at the base is the easiest way.
Usually we want more fruit. This person wants less fruit.
There's a product called Floral Growth Eliminator, growth regulator. They could see if those fruit trees are on label, but you would spray when they're in flower, but the trees seem to adapt from it. But short of removing the trees, not really.
Okay, under a minute here, Ton. They fought squash bugs last year. Any battle suggestions for this year?
Forgo growing squash for a year or two and see if they can reduce the numbers. So that's the biggest thing I can do. If the neighbors all have gardens, it may not work. But if you're fairly isolated, stopping growing squash for a year to 2 years and then beginning again for 3 or 4 years seems to be a great solution.
Okay, final question. Will a Corsican pine grow here?
I would have to look it up, but native to Corsica, probably not.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us this morning for the KSL Greenhouse. We'll be back next Saturday, 8 to 11. We do have BYU pregame coverage coming up next.